My journey has been one of returning from the darkness and stepping out into the light once more. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. While you're sitting trying to figure that out,
this is my podcast.
Allegedly. Logos Centrifugal Podcast. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. You might also be Logos Centrifugal. While you're trying to figure out what that even means for you, let me introduce today's special guest, or I should say reintroduce. It's Atlas, king of all Africa. And this is a dude who's been a great friend to me over the course of my time on the digital world. And it sort of all started out with a few questions about exercise, and then it developed into a really great sort of relationship based on appreciation of family and of brotherhood and also of similar interests. And some of those similar interests are the reason that I've invited Atlas back on the podcast today for this war series, which is he is very knowledgeable about certain aspects of politics and war and has a unique perspective because of his experiences and where he's located. And I really want to lean on that experience to help flesh out this sort of educational series for you folks. And with that very vague introduction, Atlas, welcome back. And why don't you sort of fill in the gaps of who you are and what you do as much as you want, and we can take it from there.
Thank you for having me, James. Well, I am Atlas, an African man with a purpose. I tweet about influence, strategy, propaganda, and power. And for that, I use the knowledge I have gathered and accumulated through a career of advising political leaders across the African continent. And before that, and above all of that, I am Chance's friend. Thank you for having me.
Of course, anytime, you know, it's I like to bring my friends on, especially when they're smart and have things to say, and you qualify for all those categories. So look, okay. Man, we talked a little bit before we got started about some of the things we wanted to talk about, and I know that you've come prepared. So why don't you just maybe jump in with a good place you think we should start on this, and then we can roll out from there.
Maybe we should start with introducing the arc. I think it's a very interesting arc your development here for your podcast. So I've been invited to intervene on a subject that is of a mutual interest, I'm blessed to I'm blessed with your with your invitation. The idea was to talk about war and to have multiple aspects and have different angles of tackling the subject. And the point where I am from will have, I hope, will help your listeners understand how war is waged and how it's won. Maybe from we can discuss that from current point of view on geopolitics. We might also share some points on how psychological warfare is waged and how 4D. We hear a lot about 4D warfare, and I think it might be interesting to talk about those points. So. Tell me, Chance, how did you thought about that as an arc for your listeners?
Sure, I like that. And maybe let's do this. So, you know, obviously geopolitics, you're looking at one group or nation, and then it's moving into other groups and nations and regions and things, but it all sort of starts closer. You got to sort of get into the regional politics or the national politics before you can expand out. So maybe we should start with some of the ways that politics functions within a region or a nation, talking about influence, talking about manipulation or deception, and how these tools are used to sort of build momentum into people being willing to go and put their lives on the line for something that they believe to be true, which may or may not be true.
Well, in order to stimulate or control social influences, political ideologies, or in some cases, extreme cases, to create emotionless warriors. Those in power have always needed to use some kind of manipulation techniques, what we call today, we like to call propaganda, which is a weapon that have demonstrated its effectiveness in every single armed conflict since humanity's history, since the start of humanity's history. So each conflict that has that can be impacted by public opinion must be moved to public opinion. People's mind are fields of battle in the same ways that cybernetic is a field of battle, psychology is a field of battle, and armed conflicts with physical repercussions are a field of battle. Those techniques have been developed. We've seen a rise in the use of these techniques during the 20th century. The first example we can think of is what Joseph Goebbels did for the Nazis during World War II. The aim of psychological manipulation is to impress in order to bring fear in the hearts of the enemy, or in main there are layers to manipulation strategies in the context of warfare. Depending on your objectives, you can be aiming to impress or to disinform, or to manage or to affect morale. So each of these strategies or kind of strategies have different tactics to achieve the objective. And from a political point of view, winning minds is can we cut? Are you live?
Yeah, we can pause. Yeah. Okay, so we took a little break to strategize for a minute because one of the things Atlas is really focusing in on is this should be a high value podcast. And so we decided what would be most valuable for you folks is to take a situation and sort of break it down along these different lines we've been talking about so that we can really get to the meat of the issues and demonstrate how these things work. And what we decided upon was to take a look at Libya and how these factors have been at play since the fall of Gaddafi. And so with sort of that reintroduction to what we're talking about, maybe Atlas, you can sort of break it down like you broke it down for me, and then we can get into a bit of conversation and question and answer kind of stuff here.
Yes, sure. So we were talking about warfare as a 4D exercise. And we agreed to take Libya for an example, and detail how this 4D warfare has been waged there. So since the fall of Colonel Gaddafi in 2011, if I remember correctly, Libya has been a real mess, and the consequences of the death of the dictator were that the nation split on two parts. So we had the eastern factions that are from the Benghazi and they are led by Marshal Haftar, who are backed by the UA and Egypt. So These factions are actually winning battles on the field. They have equipment, they are well-funded, and they are winning. From the other side, we have the Western factions, who are backed by the international community, the UN, the US, Turkey, and those are actually losing on the field. The only places they hold are the capital city and the suburb. Now, what's interesting about this situation is to look at the other layers of this war that is being waged in Libya and understand how the Western factions actually invested all their energy and money on narrative warfare that they won. If you are able to win the hearts, you can win a lot more. So what they did was to push their narrative in the Western world and to get funding from the United States, funding from the UN, and technical armed backup from Turkey. And what's actually happening right now is that they're gaining power on the field. That's just an example to understand how propaganda became a weapon of armies, of nations, of intelligence services. It's a science that has its rules, its methods, its tools, and with a precise objective to manipulate the minds and control perception, be it individual perception in the West, which is important for any dictatorial government, and most importantly, how Western or international governments perceive a faction versus another. Now, to put that in context, this is how politics and war is waged in third world countries. So foreign or Western governments are tools to win locally. Like on another scale, being Donald Trump or being the head of a Western powerful country is a different position. It's another game. That's why you'll see a lot of advisors and what we call professional advisors of how to spin an information, how to make it have the impact you intend on a specific aim. It's called spin doctors, and they actually don't like being called like that. But these people are very, very, very important in the entourage of any leader. I guess, be it in third world country or even in Washington or Paris or London or whoa. So as a politician or as a leader, you must anticipate the reactions of the public and to counter rumors or create rumors if you're in an offensive warfare. You have to play the game of networks to in order to push a narrative in a certain way that will benefit you maybe on the legislative field or on the armed field or so the corpus of techniques that have been used since maybe World War II have had an accumulation of a lost in trust between the political class and the public. So History had shown that leaders have always tried to influence people to submit them into doing things. And this accumulation of we cannot talk about abuse, because at that level we don't, it's not how things, it's just how things work. But people became aware and people exchanged more. And with the development of the networks, of the e-networks, in internet and social medias, population have the public have arrived to a point where anything that is being told by any political leader is met with a lot of skepticism. And this is the biggest problem for anybody. So I think it's a good way to introduce this idea of political manipulation.
Sure, and that brings me to some questions here that we can maybe fill this out a little bit with. So I think anybody familiar with the idea of political influence at this point, even if they just have a cursory familiarity, is going to understand that most people are very skeptical about the honesty and the intentions of the information that comes to them from their government. But the government is full of people who are aware of that fact as well. And the mechanisms of influence, like you talked about, social media, even the news, I mean, sort of the media in the United States, you have the normie media, as it's often called, and then you have the sort of enlightened media. But government actors manipulate both of those areas quite effectively. And I suppose my question to you is, or maybe an opportunity to get a little bit more into depth, is if I'm a sort of spin doctor A, and I understand that people are not going to be buying into the official government statement, but I still have to release one. I might release my government statement, and then I'm putting together my social network where it's not obvious that I am a government actor, and I'm influencing the reactions to that official government statement. So what you're being told and then the reactions are being shaped on both ends by the people who are trying to convince you of a certain message. And it's often said that whatever you're being told to pay attention to, both sides of that narrative are being controlled by the person who's trying to direct your attention towards that. So like if I'm just Joe Schmo at home and I see a government announcement and then I see reactions to it on the internet, I then think that I'm informed one way or the other because I'm patriotic and believe in the government, or I'm a dissenter and I'm believing the online banter. But often what's not realized is that both of those things are heavily influenced by the same actors or group of people or whatever. They're both being spun. And so I guess in the context of that, I wonder how specifically we might take a look at how that's been done in Libya and how the West was able to sort of win that narrative battle by choosing the stories to focus on, or choosing the points upon which to sort of make the crux of the matter, so that they could enlist the help of Turkey, they could enlist the support of the UN, they could create that narrative where the UAE and Egypt are the bad guys and the West and the UN and Turkey are the good guys.
That's actually a great question. There are multiple layers layers of war, and there are multiple wars. There are multiple wars that are being waged, and inside that war, and what I mean is, what is a war to Libya is just a battle to bigger players, and being able to see that from multiple perspectives helps understand a lot on the micro level, on a macro level. There are conflicting interests, but that doesn't mean the UAE and the West are enemies or opponents on other battles or field battles. If I am the leader of the losing part, of a given war, and I know that my territory is important to some big scheme of, or it's an important part of a bigger war, I will have someone help me influence a particular player or the other. I will work hard in order to have the most powerful ally with me and not against me. So there are arguments that can benefit one or the other. So if I say on the side of the Western factions that we talked about, I will try to have to bring the attention of the West on the possibility that those who are my enemies might be helping my allies or my prospect allies, enemies on other fronts. We might think about Syria, we might think about Tunisia, we might think about Egypt even. And Egypt is playing its own game with back in Khalifa Haftar on Libya. So I'm going to see who's the biggest enemy or adversary of Egypt and help me out with him. So now I have created Egypt another problem, and maybe an internal problem. And those networks are the most important parameters to identify before constructing a narrative. I have to make sure the narrative I am going to construct is positively correlated with those of my prospective allies. If I wanted the US to back me, I'm gonna talk about how my enemy is gonna let terrorist groups thrive on Libyan soil. I will talk about how Marshal Haftar is just another kind of Gaddafi, is the new Gaddafi 2.0. I'm going to talk about how my enemy is funded by some shady groups that operate on Israeli soil or American soil or have ties with Iran. Or there are multiple, that was what we were talking about. There are multiple layers. So I must, as a player, I must first identify what are the narratives that are going to provoke a reaction from a powerful ally. And if I want backing, I need to align myself with those talking points or narrative points.
Okay, so what I want to do right now is, yes, I want to lay out some stuff and then maybe just see your reaction to it. So maybe just bear with me for a second as I sort of lay out a bunch of details, and then maybe you can weave it together. Okay, so let's call it the region, the Middle East and Northern Africa. You have a predominantly Muslim population, and obviously within that you have the Sunni and the Shia conflict that's, you know, been raging for 1400 years, and then you also have Israel. And, you know, that's sort of just Judaism surrounded. And it's got a lot of support from Christian nations. And then you can talk about sort of the intelligence workings of Mossad and some of their different things and how they're in bed with the U.S. And you can take a look at something like Epstein and go, well, maybe that's how they have some influence, and every politician seems to be in support. Okay, so you have that. And then you have also okay, you have this regional conflict, and even though there are borders, the borders for this religious conflict don't respect the borders of the nations. And the borders of the sort of resource war, whether it's oil or whether it's rare minerals, they don't respect the nation's borders either. But then you do have the nation states that want to respect their borders, and you have to sort of define the boundaries of what you're willing to defend and fight for, and what sort of, you only have so much influence, you only have so many resources, you only have so many connections, and you have to strategically use those to get specific goals that are going to deliver you the highest value. So you have that. And then you have the proxy wars going on where, you know, you have sort of Russia doing what they're doing, and you have the US doing what they're doing, and you have the UN and the EU doing what they're doing. You have Iran with their fingers just in everything. And then obviously you have the actual regional actors who are doing what they're doing, but they have their own alliances. And then there's a lot of manipulation across that. Like you talked about, Turkey might be our ally in Libya, but Turkey is not our ally in different areas or et cetera. And so I guess what I'm sort of trying to get at here is that there's a degree of complexity that I think is underappreciated, especially by people who understand war through conventional terms. If you're thinking about this kind of war fighting through World War II terms, it doesn't make any sense. It's not like it's, yeah, you know, the Axis versus the Allies. It's way more complicated and way more messy than that. And sometimes it doesn't have anything to do with nation states. It has to do with religious factions. It has to do with warlords. It has to do with resources. It has to do with strategic alliances between, and mercenaries are a big thing. And then all the storytelling. So I guess when a person looks at something like Libya, where they look at this sort of regional sort of boiling center of conflict, how should they make sense of it, and how should they understand or begin to understand how to sort of put these things in layers of importance or categorize what's really happening and why the contributing factors to why a certain thing might be happening. So like Gaddafi is a good example. He was a stabilizing force in the region. He might've been dude and everything, but, but he kept that country together. And then you see what happens when he's gone is it's a mess, and it's caused destabilization that's sort of spreading out across the region. And so how does a person make sense of these different things and sort of wade through the narrative because we understand it's not true necessarily. It's just what we've been told. So can you help us make sense of all this stuff and understand what's important and why?
I think you did a great job reminding how Gaddafi was a stabilizing force in that country, and I believe it's really important to in order to understand what we're talking about, to replace each actor on the map, because the actors are not necessarily those we think they are. When we talk about warfare, you made the parallel with World War II, when we had the Axis versus Nazi Germany and Japan, and the ally versus the Axis, and now we have non-state forces that are playing bigger roles than nations. Religion is obviously something to be counted in the list of key criteria of understanding the situation, but not only that. Within the same religious groups, you may find enemy factions, and those micro politics matter when you're dealing on a scale that is actually the whole globe. In order to give an example, the attack on the Soleimani, the Iranian general, and his death by the order of the U.S. administration, has placed Iran on a very, very difficult position. Because if you were, if you today you were the Iranian leadership, what would you do? You have the you have the biggest army ever created on the surface of Earth, committing a political assassination against one of your top generals. Just as a reminder, that guy that the US killed was the main player of the region. He was Iran's man on the region from the Iraqi border to the Israeli border. He was the guy. So if you place yourself in the shoes of Iranian leadership, you don't have much choice because you just lost face because you cannot really retaliate. You're going to be exterminated in 24 hours. And you cannot allow yourself to do nothing because the result will be the same. We're gonna, the regime is going to crumble. So the only possibility is to win face on a media level, on a narrative level, and to retaliate in a more using what they have been using since the 80s, and using proxies to fight the US. And now that's pretty dangerous because it's going to be unconventional and it's going to be very, very sneaky. The best and the most efficient proxy of Iran has been Hezbollah. The, it's a militia which is based in southern Lebanon, and it's a part of the Shia Crescent, and they are very, very, very lethal. The problem with their organization is that they exist on every continent, including the American one. So the Lebanese diaspora in Mexico, which flirts with narco-terrorism, can be a real problem. And now we have a problem which is very, very, very much closer to the US soil. And if I was part of the American leadership, I'll pay attention to what's happening in the Mexican border with all these cartels that are not only drug dealers now, but they are implicated in political affairs, and they can be bribed into war, and they are not your friends. And that's the case all through the world. U.S. citizens will be targeted by unknown proxies, and that's another layer of war. That's another layer of war. And maybe it was easier back then when we had like two organized army facing each other and just fight against against a more obscure one. The notion of honor in warfare just disappeared completely from the lexicon of warfare, and now it's total warfare, and it's humanity is not prepared for this. Humanity is not prepared for this. The only thing I see which is worst is a full nuclear war, world war. But hopefully we're not there. But what we saw as what 4D warfare did is to make old powerful players more vulnerable. And if the players don't change how they think of warfare, they might lose. And the winning side is not the most obvious one, not always. I don't know if that answers your question, but
it brings me to a place I want to get into, actually. This is a good opportunity. Okay, so let's continue to use Libya as mm-hmm. as an example. Okay, so on the face of things, Gaddafi, bad. Dictator, bad. Dictatorship's bad. Okay. Yeah. The U.S. Has a big hand in, say, stirring the pot to see that Gaddafi falls. Or at least that's the thing that the U.S. population or the Western world has been told. You know, Hillary Clinton, we came, we saw, he died. So you have that end. But one thing that the enemies of the West know is that when the West commits to something like that, they commit over the long term, meaning, we had a hand in this, now we have to have involvement with it over the long term. And so the West itself, the United States itself, through these powers of sort of manipulation and propaganda and shadow war, maybe we were convinced we wanted that to happen, but let's say Russia, as an example, loves to destabilize the West. That's their main form of warfare is, let's sow disinformation, let's sow distrust, let's manipulate public opinion in a way that creates chaos. If there's two sides of an argument, let's pump our resources into both and just make sure everybody distrusts each other. So
fight, yeah.
Exactly. And anybody who thinks about it for more than a minute, especially with the example of Iraq as an example, it's like, okay, Hussein falls, everything turns into a big shitstorm. I mean, it's just a mess, and it's still a mess to this day. It's if anything, it's worse than it was when we first started into this mess. So we look at that, and then Gaddafi falls, and it's, oh, the Arab Spring, and everybody's freeing themselves from dictators, except then all the other factions move in and start stirring chaos because they know that the West, who's the enemy of basically everybody over there, long-term especially, it's like, okay, well, they're going to commit to all this and we're going to waste their resources. We're going to just suck them dry. They're going to pour billions and trillions of dollars into this region and it's all going to go up in flames. It's literally just going to destroy wealth. And that's going to sow chaos and then China's going to get them. Great. That works great for us. So you have Libya where, oh yay, the dictator's gone, except now it's a total mess. And you have proxy wars going on between the West and the East. And it's literally the West and the East too. And they're going head to head. And the West is sort of committed to maintaining face. So even though they might have won the spin war, they think, because everybody's like, oh yeah, we need to save Libya, it still requires resources, it still requires attention, it still is a drain on the total Western warfare capabilities, whether it's information or actual resources. So I guess when we look at something like this, how can a person, or how can a think tank, or how can a group who's trying to understand these concepts really sort of, and I know we're kind of circling around this, but I want to hit these different notes so people can see really how complex it is. And even though you're involved in it, even though I'm a person who studies it, it's still, unless you have all the information, which really nobody does, it's very hard to sort of have a straight line between this is what happened and this is how we got there and this is what it means. So I guess, when we look at a place like Libya, now the West is committed and Turkey's doing what they're doing there, but you know, Turkey's doing different things elsewhere. And then the media manipulation, like Qatar, is a great example of like, let's control the narrative and sow chaos. And Russia's doing the same thing and they're very, very effective at it. So how do we determine who the shadow actors are, because that will inform us a lot about the motivations or the reasons behind some of these different actions. So how does one sort of distill all of the mess into who's responsible for doing what and what their agenda might be?
There's a saying that says, follow the money, follow the power. If you can retrace if you can retrace the influx of of wealth transfer from places where war is waged to place where war is not, you can understand who's the shadow players and who's playing what. I have a friend who talks about logistics a lot, and his main point is to watch choke points in geopolitical conflicts. So if you can retrace who's benefiting from what trade, you can understand the situation better. Obviously, oil, gas, but also diamonds. In general, we can talk about natural resources as a main component of an understanding this of any given warfare situation. And if you notice, it's always places where natural resources are plenty that are theater of battles. And the real player are always miles and miles and thousands of miles away from the actual scene. And I believe that if you wanna really identify the shadow players, that's what I would follow if I wanted to do just that.
Okay.
I'm not so giving you names, but you get the idea.
Sure, and I'm more interested in principles anyway. People can sort of. I want people to do some thinking for themselves. I just want to give them the tools to do it, and we can. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. We're kind of having this conversation and smirking and stuff because it's like, well, once you actually think about it and look at it, it's like, hey, well, okay, okay, so. So we took a look at Libya and we go, okay, well, here's what happened and here's what we've been told has happened and why. And here's maybe some of the places to look to discover how much of what you've been told is true. Go ahead and do that. So now that we have sort of an example of what we've been talking about, I guess I wonder, I would like to maybe look at it from the other way and say, what if you, Atlas, were going to, okay, let's say that there is a strategic resource in a place and it's either a failed state or something close to it. And the party that you represent wants to get in there to get a strategic resource, whether it's cobalt or rare earth mineral or gold or diamonds or whatever. And it's your goal to go in there and get it. That's the plan. That's the agenda. And you've been tasked with seeing that happens, tasked with controlling the narrative and the logistics and everything. You're sort of you're the master planner. Okay. What does that look like from this is the order to it's underway and it's happening and here's how we play this? Could you maybe sort of walk us through some of that, or is that a little too close to home?
Well, I think it's doable to share the thinking process of that. First, I might try to understand the local dynamics better of the said place. So, population, number of the population, is it a danger for an extracting activity? What is the local political situation? Is it possible to extract the said resource without having conflict with the population? And is it possible to extract the said resource without having to wage to have a conflict with any powerful party that might be close geographically or not, or a proxy? As we said. So let's start with local population. If I start with the place where where it is chaos. I will probably help the least powerful one, depending on my resources, of course. But I will help the least powerful one to gain the upper hand on its rivals, and from then I will have the possibility to control the local population without having to deal with it.
Can I ask you a question real quick about that?
Yeah, sure.
You said start with the weaker party.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is that because it's easier to control the narrative with the underdog story than it is to sort of support the people who are in power? Because whenever people are in power, they're abusing it. It's just sort of one of the rules.
Yes.
So if you support the guy who's got less power, does that help you sort of win the hearts and minds kind of a thing?
It will help me win the hearts and minds in the general population, say when I'm waving a certain narrative outside the said place, will be easier for me to do so. Also, the weaker part will need me in order to stay in power. So if I use the weaker part as a proxy, this element will need me in order to stay, and then cannot be. It's an eternal ally, because without my presence, this part wouldn't be at the position it is. So this part needs me in order to stay, and I need this part to use as proxy to secure the area from a security point of view and from a narrative point of view.
Okay, so take us from there. Yeah, good.
Yeah, from there I would try to analyze the situation on a little broader scale, and to make sure I'm the only one who wants or able to extract the said resource. And from there we have to study the logistic part of it. I don't have the details, but my guess would be to study the cost structure of extracting the said resource, and to study how to move the resource from a point B from point A to a point B, maybe to my home country or to my market or to another ally that will use the said resource for anything may need. So we still have to position ourselves in one layer of the layers. We should be aware of what is being played on the level above us, and be aware of the game that is being played on the level below us. Try to influence the best we can on the level below us, and try to play above us the parts one against the other, in order to have the best possible outcome.
So within that frame, if we're looking at strategy, sort of in that frame of reference, we know that there are people below us who we're going to have an easier time manipulating, because maybe we have power advantage or money advantage or political advantage or probably all of those things. And the people above us, they're in the, you know, and each of these levels has an above and below, obviously, too, until you get to a certain point, and then it's the top level, but
there are always something above.
Right. So when you're looking at that, like if I go in, maybe I'm using proxies or maybe I'm hiring mercenaries to go in and do a thing, but I want to have plausible deniability. So I make it look like somebody else hired the mercenaries, or maybe like I pretend to hire the mercenaries and then I unleash them in the area and then I don't pay them. And then they're stuck in this place with their machine guns, and there's resources and stuff to be had, and they start trying to pirate stuff and being bandits. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sowing chaos that I can go in there. These kinds of strategic things. And I guess what I'm what I'm looking at in this context is, what are some of the factors that will tell you whether or not you want to, like, let's say that there's an existing logistics framework. Maybe you want to destroy it because it's on lockdown by your opponent, or maybe you want to maintain it and just sort of take it over. Or how do you decide whether or not, or how much chaos to introduce, or how much you can just maneuver within the existing framework to sort of grow your own influence within that existing network? What are some of the factors that you look at when you're trying to decide how you're going to get what you want?
I would say do it like you were thinking about an investment. What is the return on the investment is? But not just from a financial point of view, because war costs a lot, and the financial cost is not the only one to take into account when you're taking these kind of decisions. There's always so much chaos you can bring into a place, but chaos should not become a liability in order to attain your objectives. And I see it as how much you're ready to invest in chaos without threatening the possibility that your desired outcome become a reality. I'm going to give an example because it's very abstract as an idea. If I'm going to create so much chaos in a region that will not allow or will cost me a lot to reintroduce, I don't know, machinery or equipment that will allow me to extract said resource, then I'm on losing side. I'm on the losing side because I would have maybe destroyed an existing infrastructure that will only make extraction possible on a small scale, only benefits, I don't know, smugglers or small criminals. Or that's for example what happened in Syria during the reign of ISIS, where basic infrastructure has been destroyed and only smuggling type ISIS could benefit from it. And now we're not destroying anything for the, even if we are an agent of chaos, we're not benefiting from this and only make the enemy benefit from it. And that's the main thing I would think of if I was in that situation. Were you thinking about it just from a financial point, or were you? Because I understand the question, but I don't see from what angle of perception are you thinking about this.
So that's actually a good spot to hit, and I like that because it was rather open, and I just wanted to see your thoughts on it. There's this great line from the book The New Rules of War by Sean McFay, which he's been on the podcast before. He's coming back on, and he says you can think of a drug cartel in Mexico as the combination between a multinational corporation and a terrorist organization, and when you look at an organization like that, the difference between something like that and a nation state is just sort of the legitimacy that other nation states will give to a nation state versus sort of like a narco terrorist organization. But the differences on the field or in application, the narco organizations in Mexico, they wage war against each other. They wage war against the United States. They wage war against the sort of weak Mexican government. And that's for all intents and purposes, Mexico is a failed state and is now a narco state. And it's just different warring factions. It's very much the same as if you were looking at, say, Libya or something like this. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the Zetas, you have the Sinaloa, you have these different organizations that control regions, and they fight each other, and they'll cut off each other's heads and hang them from bridges, or they'll murder each other's children if they have to, whatever they have to do to sort of win. And when in a situation like that, the sort of hearts and minds issue, it becomes a different factor, or the chaos becomes a different factor. And I guess looking at, Here's what I want to do, because I'm kind of rambling on here, and I want to bring it home for a lot of my listeners who either live in the U.S. or live in Western countries. If I look at the breakdown of people who listen or watch my podcast, it's like 85% United States, and then the next 10% are Western countries, and then there's like a few sort of less Western-oriented countries. So if I look at the United States right now, say, and I look at the media and the spin around Donald Trump and Russia, and I look at the conflicts we're involved in, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or Libya or any of the other proxy situations in some of the less well-publicized conflicts in the Middle East and in Northern Africa or these kinds of things, how, considering all that we've talked about, whether it's the politics or whether it's the money or whether it's the sort of shadow war, how would you suggest that somebody in the West, United States most specifically, but just in general, could take a look at the sort of total U.S. involvement in these conflicts and begin to understand the reasons why they're involved, what the agenda really probably is, and who our adversaries really are?
I think the biggest adversary of the United States is and will be China for the next 2 to 3 decades. The involvement of the United States in the Middle East is something that is beneficial to the U.S. To the U.S. people and the U.S. government. The U.S. doesn't need no more Middle Eastern oil nor gas. And the main reason for the American presence militarily and and all intelligence efforts there is mainly to protect Israel. And I can understand the strategic alliance between the two countries, but I think a lot of energy, a lot of funding, and a lot of efforts is being wasted on that front. While China is a bigger threat, China is having its economic proxies just down the U.S. border in Mexico. It's having its Silk Road rebuilt. It's dominating across Africa. And this is a real danger. And I get the impression that it's quite being overlooked in Washington, D.C. And not enough efforts are being put into stopping China. Because I am not an American, but I'd rather American
hegemony over Chinese one, and I've seen what Chinese hegemony looks like. The U.S. wants to stay the top dog. Chinese are the enemy, and they are very, very serious about what they're doing.
Okay, so in that context, where do you see the relationship between the bear and the dragon going, between Russia and China? Because obviously, from a media standpoint, Russia's been the big bad boogeyman for 50 years now, and there's a lot of money involved in making sure that stays the case, whether it's through China having essentially purchased Hollywood, essentially purchased a lot of the politicians in Washington, whether it's through Qatar and them doing very much the same thing, buying media and buying politicians and messaging in a certain way, and whether it's Russia themselves, Putin just really enjoying the fact that he can mess up everything for the United States with very little sort of concrete resources. It's just information warfare, which, you know, that's his specialty and that's how he came to power in the first place. I mean, you look at the bombings that sort of allowed him to, oh, look, Chechen war again. This is great. And oh, it looks like I probably did this, but don't tell anybody, okay? and now I'm in power and I control trillions of dollars. So I guess I'm curious, and maybe this would be a good point to start winding it down, because we're an hour and a half in and we took a little break, but we're getting pretty good. And there's a lot, right, that we've talked about for people to think about. So I wonder, maybe break down the Russia thing and then also relate it to China and how we can look at those two forces as sort of both of them are our strategic enemies. And then how do we understand the relationship that they have with each other and their strategic relationship?
The Russian-Chinese relationship is pretty complex. One of the things that helped Henry Kissinger in his career is breaking down the communist alliance between the USSR and China. And from that point, they might collaborate in order to put down the common enemy. But there is a lot of defiance and skepticism between Beijing and Moscow. There's a play that can be done here to prevent them from allying against the U.S. But the combination of their strength, economic strength, for Beijing, and the narrative warfare as it is waged by Putin's agents nowadays can be deadly for the US. Now the main adversary of the US in the Middle East is Russia, not China. China is doing its thing in the other parts of the globe, and mainly in Africa, but not in the Middle East. The Middle East, for me, like I said, it's a huge waste of resources and huge waste of energy putting that much effort into this field of battle. So two points: prevent them from allying in the Middle East region. And points to concentrate on the Pacific. not necessarily as a military operation, but on an intel level, that's what the U.S. must do. Break that alliance in the Middle East and concentrate on the Pacific front.
To what extent do you think that it would be possible to create a more or to influence a more adversarial relationship between those two powers?
The CIA has a long tradition of making regimes crumble from the inside and make them rot. That's the way to go.
Okay. That's a loaded subject right there. I think I'll just let people think about that. Okay. So look, man, we sort of started very broadly and then we honed in on an example and then we opened it back up. And then we closed into something that's a little more relevant to the West, which is most of my audience. But because the United States is so influential, it matters to everybody. And I think that's good. And so I guess I wonder at this point, this is something that you care about. These are things that you concern yourself with, and we can just sort of leave the specifics there. But what do you hope people who have listened to this will take away, and are there any questions or anything that you feel like this subject needs to be asked but rarely are? I'm just, what do you hope people take away from this conversation, or that they need to understand, and sort of distill that into a few points that would be most important for people to really get a hold of?
What I tweet about and what I intend with and my intent with this podcast and even the previous one is to make people aware of the games being played around them. It's not only about geopolitics or resource extraction or how intel works or how logistics work. The idea is to be aware of games being played on your daily life and how strategic thinking on international level is the same game played on your social level. And if you are to notice and to understand how things are going between nations, between corporations, between, these are the same, pretty much the same way wars are being waged on individual level. And this is what is going to happen in the next decade. We are going to have to be able to defend ourselves on digital warfare. And people are becoming brands. And brands fight each other like nations fight each other in order to capture resources. And we live more and more in the attention economy, and people's attention is actually the resource, the main resource. My message to your listeners is this. Think of your strategic position like you are a country.
I
use
like
your
that.
Brain instead of your limbic system. That's the best thing to do. The only aim of bringing up those situations and illustrations on national, international levels is to make our listeners, our followers, our subscribers aware that those techniques are being used on a daily basis between people. So if you want to win, if you want to succeed, and after all, we're all part of the self-development community. We all want to develop ourselves. And this strategic thinking is a necessary tool in order to thrive on the financial, on emotional, on every field of war. Life is war. And that's my message.
Man, I'm really glad you came on the podcast, my friend Atlas, because
I'm happy to see you.
This is There's so much for people to think about from this conversation, and it's going to illuminate a lot of the other topics or inform on all of them, essentially, that I'll be hitting on. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come and share some of your knowledge and expertise on the matter. And it's exactly what I wanted it to be. And so I just want to commend you on bringing a lot of value and to thank you for taking the time to do it, because I know time is precious. And thank you for taking the time to share some of yours with me.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That was a great pleasure. That's very
is
great.
There,
I'm really pleasure to talk with you. Yeah.
Oh, man. Otter. You're just my pal, man. Come on. are there any parting things you want to say?
Yeah.
And if not, then why don't you tell people where they can find you if they want to learn more about what you're talking about?
So my hope is we can make I can make another appearance on your podcast if you allow me to, and have a better structured conversation. We do I ramble a lot, and that's the part of that's the charm of it. So I'm blessed with your friendship and with the opportunity to share my views on subject that can be seem as boring to the average Joe, but are important on an individual level, not only for people watching CNN and Fox News and interested in Joe politics and what else. You can follow me on Twitter at Dentist Leo. And thanks for having me, bro.
Yeah, man. Cool. So if you're good, I'm good, I think. Okay, let's make it happen again down the road. I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to be wrapping this series up, but it might be worth bringing together a few minds and maybe having, you know.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
A larger group.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So consider that. And and with that, sure. This has been the Logos and Trivial podcast. I've been Chance Lunsford. You've been Atlas, King of all Africa. And all of this has only been allegedly. And we're out.